2. 1 Peter chapter 2. Have you ever been in a place where you just didn't feel comfortable? I think that probably most of us at some time in our life, we've been in places like that. This past Tuesday, I was going to a preacher's fellowship. I was talking to Brother Don on Monday, and I told him I was going to go, and I said, "Do you want to go with me?" He said, "Man, I'd love to go." And so we got it set up, and then there was another brother that he's going to our college right now. As a matter of fact, his dad preceded Brother Don coming to Corinth. It was Brother Gordon Pitter. Well, it was his son named Paul. And so Paul came with Brother Don, and we got in my truck, and we drove down to the University Baptist Church. And after we heard a couple of preachers preach, there was a brother in the church that wanted to take us out to eat. And I mean, I'm thinking that we're going to probably go down to the, you know, to the church dining hall, you know, and have something down there. And they said, "No," said, "you got to go over to Peachtree Street." And they gave the address to it, and I had to use Siri to find it. We went into the wrong building the first time. You know, they got a bunch of buildings down there. So finally we found the right building, and the place we were eating was on the 18th floor of some financial building that's down there. And when you went in, you had all these waiters and waitresses. I mean, they didn't have paper hats on, let's just put it that way. And I began to think, I don't know if I really belong here or not. I even asked the valet, I said, "Do I need to wear a coat or can I go without a coat?" He said, "You might ought to take it." Come to find out, if your cell phone goes off in there, they either take the cell phone or they kick you out. And here we are at this place, and I'm just thinking, wow. I'm eating at a place that's up here like filet mignon when I'm used to eating Big Macs. And I was sitting next to the member of the club, and he was just an average-looking fella, but they all knew his first name. And all I'm praying is this: dear God, please don't let me pick up the wrong fork. There were three forks. There were two knives, multiple plates, and multiple glasses and cups. And I thought, I heard sometime in my memory banks, you start with the little fork. And so I started with the little fork, and all I'm thinking is, please, dear Lord, don't let me knock water all over in this man's lap. I was nervous the whole morning. I mean, it was actually afternoon. It was about 12:30 when we started. And I just I never did get comfortable, all right? Fortunately, nobody said anything about what utensil I was using. The food was pretty good. Probably wasn't the best food I ever had, but it was pretty good. And I just kept thinking, Lord, I don't know that I could do this all the time. I mean, it's good to do it once or twice in your life, but I'm just kind of out of place here. And it's because I'm just not used to it. I mean, we're talking people that are eating there that make multi-million dollar deals, and, you know, and I worry about $100, you know, that type of stuff. Well, our passage today is kind of in that same vein. And I titled it Just Passing Through, and the reason is because you and I, we're not going to be here forever. We are not going to be here forever. In the book of Peter, it is written, if you flip back over, we're not going to read it, but if you looked at verse 1 of the first chapter, you would see a bunch of names, things like Cappadocia. Basically, if you were to look at a map today, it's modern-day Turkey. That's where the people that he is writing to are at. Now, who is he writing to? Well, he says that they are scattered. In other words, what you've got is you've got a bunch of scattered people, but then he uses a word that's kind of strange. He says they're scattered strangers. And he begins to give a little background about, I know what you're going through. In verse 6, he basically tells them, he said, I know about the temptations that you've been facing. In verse 7, he talks about the fiery trial that they are going through. And some people say, well, it was probably, you know, just kind of a picture of what they were going through. Well, that could be. But I want you to remember this, that this book was written somewhere in late 64, early 65 A.D. What took place in Rome in 64 A.D. was a great fire. You remember there was a Caesar named Nero. And Nero was basically a crazy man. You know, we've all heard the little thing about Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Well, Nero basically wanted to take some of the ghettos that were, in Rome, and he wanted to kind of clear them out so that he could build a bigger palace for himself. But because there were so many people there that were balking at that, he couldn't really do it. And so what he did was, the story goes that he had some of his henchmen go out and set fires in the night and basically burned the ghetto down. And when there was such an uproar, he said, the Christians did it. And because of that, persecution began to be amped up. Early in the Christian community, in the early church, it was Jewish persecution. But then when it got into the 60s, it became Roman persecution. And it was so bad that Nero would line his garden at night by having human torches of Christians that had been dipped in wax, that type of thing. And so that's the background that we have. And in verse 11 of chapter number 2, he says this, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul. Having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. The first thought is this: there's a right way to think. I want you to notice the first part of verse 11. He says, dearly beloved. He said, you as strangers and as pilgrims. And I want you to know that there is a right way to think. Often we hear a word we did maybe 15 years ago called a paradigm. And basically what that means is it means a mindset, the way that you think. And as Christians, we are to have a certain mindset. First of all, he wants these people to know that they are loved. He calls them beloved. The next thing that he does is he wants them to understand their identification. They're a stranger. You say, well, what in the world is a stranger? Well, it's a person that's away from home. All of us have been strangers. We've been away from our homes for different things. You may go on vacation and you're a stranger in Florida. You may go on vacation and you're a stranger in the Caribbean. You may go on vacation and you may go up to the Smoky Mountains. Brother Perry Voyle just got finished going out to California and the Grand Canyon. He drove 6,000 miles. I thought, Lord, have mercy. 6,000 miles? I mean, that's like taking a beating. I said, do you realize that you drove far enough to get to Israel? I mean, that is a lot of driving. Well, you know what? He was a stranger in California. I couldn't help, whenever he was telling me that, to think about a story I heard many years ago about an old Baptist preacher from South Georgia. He had a daughter that lived in California, And she had been out there for years, and him and his wife had never been out there. And he thought, well, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a vacation from the church. I'm going to take a month off. We're going to go halfway through June, and we're going to come back at the middle of July. So they're driving out through the West, and they get to the California line. And he stops to fill up with gas, and he goes in, and he begins talking to the attendant, his friendly folks from Georgia do. And the guy said, well, where are you going? He said, well, said my daughter, who we hadn't seen in quite a while, said she lives in this place right here called San Jose. And the guy said, what? Said, yes, and she lives right here. It's on the map in San Jose. He said, well, sir, that's not really the way we pronounce it in California. He said, that's pronounced San Jose. He said, the J's sound like H's. And he said, oh, man, I appreciate you telling me that. He said, by the way, how long are you and your wife going to be visiting your daughter? He said, well, we're going to stay out there 3 or 4 weeks. Said, we're going to come back either in late June or early July. So sometimes, you know, we just don't belong certain places, all right? And so when you look at our passage, it says you're a stranger, it's somebody that's away from home. But then there's another word, it's a pilgrim. Some people call this a sojourner. And what that simply means is that it's somebody that is living in a place, but they don't belong there. It's very similar to a stranger. They may have a home there, but that's not their home. And so there's a right way for us to think. How many of you remember the song Mansion Over Hilltop? You remember that song, so I'm satisfied with a mansion below? Then it says, I'm just a pilgrim in search of a city. And so what you got is you've got the right mindset that we ought to have. The scriptures tell us that we're not supposed to love the world. Bible tells us in 1 John 2:15, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. You say, well, can you identify the world? Absolutely. It simply means this. It is human life and society without God. In other words, the way that we live our life is with God, and we're not supposed to love anything that's without God. And that's just a very, very simple definition. The second thing I want you to see is found in the latter part of verse 11. The latter part says, I want you to abstain from fleshly lust or desires which war against the soul. There's a right way to fight. There's a wrong way and there's a right way. And one of the ways that we have to fight is we've got to basically volunteer to be on the Lord's side. You know, I remember as a little boy, we would sing the song, I may never march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the artillery. I may never zoom o'er the enemy, but I'm in the Lord's army. We sing a song, onward Christian soldiers, marching as to war with the cross of Jesus going on before. I'm afraid that if we're not careful, Christians today don't really sing onward Christian soldiers. Sometimes we may say backward Christian soldiers fleeing from the fight with the cross of Jesus barely in sight. That may be where we're at today. And so there's a right way for us to fight. Look with me at the words that are used. There's a word, first of all, that says conversation in verse 12. But there's a word also in verse 11 that when I get to conversation, it'll be behavior, our manner of life. But when you look at verse 11, there's a word that is a companion with that when it says abstain. What does that word abstain have to do with our behavior? Well, the word abstain simply means that we have a choice to hold something away from ourselves. So in other words, if we abstain from voting, we didn't go and vote. If we abstain from attending a meeting, we just decided we wouldn't go to the meeting. Well, we are to abstain from fleshly lust. You say, well, what kind of lust is that? Well, I think that it could either be good or bad. Do you know there's some things that are really good that can be bad? It all has to do with how you do it. This past Tuesday, when I went to that luncheon, I could have had all kind of food there. I could have gone back 5, 6, 7, 8 times if I'd have wanted to. It was a buffet. But I'm thinking, Lord, don't let me make a fool of myself. Help me to just be moderate in what I'm doing. Help me to sip on my water without dropping it. And so basically, I could have been a glutton. I could have just gone back 4 or 5 times. And I'm telling you, nobody would have said a word. But all I'm thinking is, I want to be a good testimony for the man that I'm sitting next to. We can do other things that are bad. Sometimes when we think of lust, we always think of something when it comes to morality. But it could be just simply desires that are within our hearts. And so we are to abstain from those fleshly lusts. When you look also at verse 11, I want you to underline the word war. Because a war is not a battle. A war is made up of many battles. But this word has the idea of an encampment. So what is he saying? Abstain from those desires that you have because they begin to war against the soul. They encamp against the soul. The encampment is where the enemy surrounds a city. If you ever go to Israel, and by the way, we're talking about maybe trying to take another trip to Israel in November of 2018, a year from this November. So if you're interested, we'll talk with you about that. But if you go to Israel, just above the Dead Sea is a place called Masada. And it's way up elevated up on a mountain. It was built by Herod the Great, and it was one of the palaces that he would use. And when the rebellion of the Jews were going on in the 60s in Jerusalem, Rome had begun to just literally smash the resistance. And a group of Jews left Jerusalem, went to Masada thinking, they will never get us here. And if you stand on the top and you look off all down below you, you can see what looks like little squares. And what that is that is Roman encampments where they would have platoons here, 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 and all around that huge mountain. You can see where the Romans had camped. It's still visible today, just a little less than 2,000 years later. And so the Romans basically encamped about the people of Masada. And then they began to build a ramp. You see, the Romans just weren't soldiers, they were engineers. They found the shortest height, which was just a little over 200 feet, and they began to build a ramp, and they built the ramp, and they built the ramp, and they went straight up that ramp. And that's how they went into the city of Masada. But the people could not get away because they were encamped. That's what the fleshly lusts do to our souls. And so when you look at that, go, man, I've got to abstain from that. And so the second thing I want you to see is there's a right way to fight. The third thing that I want you to see is there's a right way to behave. Look at verse 12, the first part. Having your conversation, the word that I used a little earlier, on the board you can see that I have put in parentheses the word behavior. Having your behavior honest among the Gentiles. The word honest is a word that is used over 100 times in the New Testament. It's basically a word that means good. It's a word that has the idea of something that is beautiful. It's something that that is looked upon with favor. And let's face it, when we think of honesty, we think of something that's good. Nobody likes it when somebody lies to you. If you've got a character flaw and you lie, people look at you and they think, I have no use for that guy. Because if you lie, you can't be trusted. And so when it says, having your conversation honest or good among the Gentiles. Now, who are the Gentiles? Well, it's not just people that are not Jewish. In the context, it's people that are unsaved. So if we were to say to us today, we need to behave because the unsaved world is looking at us. We need to make sure that we're trying to live right because the world is looking at us. And so when we look at this passage, it's the right way to behave. I don't know about you, but I can't read the Gospels and read the stories of Jesus without seeing goodness just ooze from the Lord. You think about the number of times that maybe a mother brought the little child that maybe was sick to Jesus. What about the times whenever the fathers would bring their children to Jesus? What about the times whenever the society, the leaders in the Sanhedrin would bring somebody to Jesus like they did in John chapter 8 and cast this woman that was taken in the very act of adultery before Jesus and say, Moses' law said to stone her. What do you say? And with tenderness and with respect, he said, he that's without sin cast the first stone. And she looked at him as they all left, and she said, Lord, where are my accusers? And he said, they're gone. And he said, neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. Isn't that just good? Because every one of us in here, we've sinned. Aren't you glad that Jesus didn't say, stone him? I'm glad he said, forgiven. What about the woman in John chapter 4 in the city of Sychar? Jesus didn't have to go through Sychar, but there was one woman there that he needed to talk to. She was a Samaritan woman. Been married multiple times. I mean, she's coming to get water in the middle of the day because the other women that came in the cool of the day didn't want anything to do with her. But Jesus said, I got some water that's living water. And she said, give me that water. And he cared about a woman that society had outcast. And so when you look at Jesus in the New Testament, you've got Jesus and he is simply good. He treats people right. But may I say this? Jesus was often accused of wrong. It was always a lie. But he was often accused of wrong. They accused him of being a drunk. They accused him of hanging out with sinners. They accused him of all types of things. They accused him of being demon-possessed. They said, the work that you do, it's by the power of Beelzebub. And they accused him of things that were 180 degrees from being true. And do you know, you're not any different? Look at the middle part of verse 12. Whereas they speak against you as evildoers. People are going to look at you and they're going to say, I know why you're doing that. And they're going to question your motives. I know why you're doing that. You're trying to get rich. I know why you're trying to do that. This is what you want to happen. You know why they do that? Because they question themselves, because they know their own heart. They question others because they've been burned so many times. And so they look at you, they accuse Jesus, and we're not better than our master. Do you know one of the things that they accused you Christians of, if you would have been in New Testament times? They would have accused you of incest. You know why? because they talked about loving the brothers and sisters. Their idea of love was an erotic love, whereas Jesus' type love was an agape type love. It was a deep, abiding love. There was nothing sensual about the love that Jesus had. That's why you have people, whenever they want to rag on Jesus and talk about, oh yeah, you know, I read in those Gnostic Gospels about Jesus really, you know, had a baby with Mary Magdalene. You don't find that in the Scriptures. What you find is you find somebody with a vile mind that's trying to denigrate Christ. And so when you look at the life of Christ and the life of those other early Christians, they would say, yeah, they believed in incest. You know what else they believed in? They believed that Christians practiced cannibalism. You go, what do you mean by that? How many of you partake in the Lord's table every once in a while when we do it here? We take that little fruit of the vine. We take that little wafer. And those early Christians would say, this is the Lord's body. This is the Lord's blood. And those Romans are going, cannibals. And they would be accused of cannibalism. It wasn't true because it was all symbolic. Just like we do today. We take the juice, which is unfermented grape juice. And we take the unleavened bread, which speaks of the sinless body of Christ. And we partake of it, but it has no saving power. That's a papist idea. All it is symbolic of the fact that Jesus shed his blood and Jesus' body was given on the cross. And so we have a right way to behave. Look at the latter part of verse 12, and I'll give you the last thought. Remember why we should behave. Why? Which they shall behold glorify God. Now, the they there are the Gentiles, the unsaved people. Which they, the unsaved, shall behold or see. They glorify God. Why? Because of our behavior. And they're going to glorify God in the day of visitation. Now let me tell you what that visitation is not. It's not what we're going to have the last Saturday in this month when we have a church-wide visitation. And I'm hoping to have about 25 teams that'll go out on that Saturday morning and just basically go and visit people in this community and letting them know what's going on at this church. And if they don't know Christ, talk to them about the Lord. That's not the visitation that is mentioned here. The visitation carries the idea that comes over from the Old Testament. And it's got the idea of judgment. And so when we read it, it says that they are going to glorify God in the day of judgment. Now, a visitation of God can be good or it can be bad. It can be either. First of all, the Bible tells us in Ruth chapter 1, it says that there was a lady named Naomi. And Ruth is a beautiful, beautiful book in the Old Testament. It talks about a kinsman redeemer and those types of things. But Naomi was the grandma. And she had gone to Moab with her husband and her two boys. When they got to Moab, her boys had married two girls, one of them named Ruth, one named Orpah. And then the husband dies. Then the two boys die. And so what you've got is you've got a lady and two daughters-in-law. There's a famine in the land. And somehow she hears in Moab that God, in verse 6, has visited Judah. And how did God visit Judah? By giving them bread. And she said, I'm going home. And they started out and she stopped and she said, girls, why don't you go back to your people? Find somebody else to marry. Your husbands are dead. Find somebody else to marry. And Orpah turned and went back, but Ruth said, not me, I'm going with you. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. Why? They went because God had visited people of Judah with bread. But there's also another passage in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 10. And what that talks about is it talks about God visiting his people in wrath. And so when you look at the latter part of verse 12, you can look at that in two ways. You can look at it that God will be glorified by those that trust him. But ultimately, God is going to be glorified by those that deny him. It's just a matter of when. We have people that are in this country today. I see them on comment boards when I'm reading different news articles to catch up with what's going on in the country and in the world. And if it's almost invariably, whenever it's something that has to do with religion or with God, there's always those that come out of the woodwork that want to talk about, you know, that great, great fabled God up in the sky, that great mystical make-believe creature that's in the sky. And they want to denigrate Jesus, and they want to denigrate Christians and all of that. But the Bible tells us in the book of Philippians chapter 2 that there's coming a day when every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess to the glory of God that Jesus is Lord. Today, the overwhelming majority of people that sit here, you have already bowed the knee to Jesus. But make no mistake, if you have not, there will be one day that you will. You will bow, and you'll not have any choice about it. There's coming a day when every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess. The title of the message has been, Just Passing Through. Now you say, why did you use that? Well, because that's what strangers and pilgrims do. They can't stay where they're at. I shared a story on Thursday with our senior people. Probably one of the greatest preachers of the 20th century, especially the latter part of the 20th century, was a black brother named E.V. Hill. Great pulpiteer. And one of his messages, he made this statement, talking about how that people like it where they're at. He said, folks, you need to know something. You can't stay here. You can't stay. We've got people that are in this room probably from 5 years old to 95 years old. All in between. There's coming a time when none of us, from the youngest to the oldest, will be able to stay. We're going to leave this place. My wife and I live on Lee Peters Road. But I told her just 2 weeks ago, I said, one day somebody else will live in this house. One day somebody else will go out to that shop. One day, somebody else will probably plant a garden. And may I say this, that one day somebody else is going to live in your house? Somebody else is going to cut your grass. You say, I wished it was now. But somebody else is going to plant that garden in your backyard. Somebody else is going to sleep in that bedroom that you love. You know why? Because you couldn't stay. The stocks that you've got right now, you won't keep them forever. The money you got in the bank right now, it won't be yours forever. Why? You can't stay. And what you better do is you better start thinking about what's over yonder. You better start thinking about what's beyond the veil of death. And what we ought to do is realize that we're just passing through, folks. So this morning, if you don't know Christ, you need to bow. You need to do business with God today. It's my prayer that if you don't know Christ, that you'll come. And if you do know Christ, I pray that our conversation, our behavior will be so good that when the unsaved people look at our lives, they'll say, boy, they got a good God. I tell people often, we got one job, make Jesus look good. Let's make Jesus look good. Let's stand together, heads bowed, eyes closed.